from the studios of Kootenai Co-op Radio, this is Deconstructing Dinner.
And welcome to Deconstructing Dinner, a syndicated weekly one-hour radio program and podcast produced at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY, in Nelson, British Columbia. I'm John Steinman. I did announce on our most recent broadcast, as part of our new series entitled Livestock Lost, that today's episode would continue with coverage on the small-scale abattoir proposed in the West Kootenai region of British Columbia. But because of some recent and important activities surrounding the project that will be finalized shortly, we've instead been encouraged to postpone that episode so that we can be certain to fully capture the importance and underlying messages that this story will help bring to light. So again, do stay tuned for part two of the Livestock Lost series. And you can also expect an upcoming part two of the Local Grain Revolution series we launched here on the program back in March of this year. A lot has transpired since then, including our very broadcast having inspired an article in Canada's most read newspaper, The Globe and Mail. And that, in and of itself, is an interesting story to explore as well. And so on today's broadcast, we will instead take a look at a topic that we've covered here on the show before, and it's one of a significant importance. The first segment today will mark the fourth installment of our series titled Cooperatives, Alternatives to Industrial Food. Today's installment will revisit with the topic of land cooperatives as a solution to many of the barriers facing local food production, one of which being the incredibly high cost of acquiring land for agricultural purposes. We'll listen to recordings from my visit to the March 2008 conference of the Certified Organic Associations of BC, held in Saanich. It was there I recorded Ramona Scott of the Land Conservancy and Heather Pritchard of Farm Folk City Folk speaking in a workshop on their relatively new Community Farms program. We'll also hear segments of an interview with Ramona Scott recorded by Kootenai Co-op Radio's John Alton. And rounding off today's show, part three of the Cross Canada Trike Tour, when we'll revisit with Derek Hahn, one of two cyclists currently making his way across the country while promoting this very radio show, Deconstructing Dinner. I spoke with Derek as they made their way east from Rivière-du-Loup, Quebec. A topic of discussion throughout many broadcasts of Deconstructing Dinner that while there may very well be a widespread interest in supporting more localized food systems, the bigger picture of how such systems can be physically, economically, and politically sustained is a far more complicated and serious matter. So long as we as a society here in North America continue to place food and agriculture alongside the same market-based systems of economics governing all other products, the preservation and access to farmland in close proximity to urban centers will only become increasingly harder to maintain. And that is exactly what's been happening in most parts of the country where agricultural land has become next to worthless in the face of a lowest price is the law global food system. And in turn, we see cities sprawling into the rural countryside because housing developments are far more valuable than food production. Well, of course, such trends are a short-term gain and a long-term loss in light of the rapidly changing face of energy resources, environmental impacts of our consumer-driven culture, and population health being on a plummeting decline. So what's the solution? Well, there are, of course, many, and one of them is a project currently being expanded on by the Land Conservancy of British Columbia, TLC, and Vancouver-based Farm Folk City Folk. The program is called the Community Farms Program, and we first spoke of this back on April 19th, 2007, when we met with the Horse Lake Community Farm Cooperative, just outside the town of 100 Mile House, BC. Now, while specific to BC, this is a model that could very well be applied anywhere in North America. And so first, what is a community farm? Well, most importantly, a community farm is a more holistic approach to food production than what we've seen happening in the past few decades, in that such farms represent a multifunctional approach to agriculture that produces additional outputs to food and fiber, such as ecological services, bioenergy, landscape preservation, employment, cultural heritage, food quality and safety, and animal welfare. It's a model that permits food to be incorporated into our lifestyles the way food has been for thousands of years, and in most parts of the world still is. A farm that becomes a part of the Community Farms program is collectively owned in public trust, and long-term leases are assigned for local food production, and farmers are also housed on the land. Agricultural activities are small scale and intensive and are carried out by a group of people working collaboratively or cooperatively. Now, the aim of the program is to first and foremost expand local food production in BC by number one, helping new farmers access affordable land, and number two, researching best practices of existing collectively owned farms and creating a network of potential farmers, landowners, and community organizations. Now, there are already some farms in operation as part of the program, with a number of others in the process of being brought into that program. The ones in current operation are the Fraser Common Farm Co-op in Aldergrove, Glen Valley Organic Farm Co-op in Abbotsford, Halliburton Farm in Victoria, Horse Lake Community Farm Co-op outside of 100 Mile House, and Linnea Farm on Cortez Island. Working as part of the Land Conservancy on this project is Ramona Scott, the manager of agricultural programs with TLC. Ramona was interviewed by Kootenai Co-op Radio's John Alton on July 8th to learn more about the project and why a land conservation organization has become so involved in farming.
Well, actually, the Land Conservancy has been working in agriculture through its whole history of, I guess this is our 11th year in existence. We've always worked with agriculturalists, ranchers primarily at the beginning, because so many of the properties that have great ecological values are farmland or ranch land. So we have been working. In fact, one of our first properties was Talking Mountain Ranch, which we purchased just on the west side of the Fraser River, north of Lillooet. So we have been dealing with some ranchers and farmers and vintners and orchardists because of the ecological values on farmland all along. But recently it became really clear as we started to really study how conservation and agriculture work together, like that biodiversity, natural biodiversity is there, but actually, agriculture can work with conservation and create and support biodiversity by its own cropping and the methods and the sustainable practices that farmers do. So we had formed this program called Conservation Partners Program, which really is an educational program about how conservation and agriculture work together. And we give recognition to farmers and ranchers who do really good practices and protect habitat on their land. And we have a label that's a butterfly label that is called our Conservation Partners label. And then as time has been going on in the last couple of years, as everybody knows, the topic of food security and the growing concern over loss of farmland, the loss of farmers, it became really clear that not only would we be needing to look at land for its biodiversity, but we better start working at actually protecting farmland because it's such a rare commodity, really, in BC, relatively speaking, compared to the entire area of BC.
Launching from TLC's work on agriculture, the Community Farms Program was born as a partnership with Farm Folk City Folk, a Vancouver-based not-for-profit that works with farm and city to cultivate a local, sustainable food system. Ramona Scott describes the partnership between TLC and Farm Folk City Folk's Heather Pritchard.
What Heather and I have been doing as partners is developing a program called Community Farms Program for British Columbia, and it's essentially an alternative model for putting land into production and protecting land. And Heather has lots of experience at this because she's living on a cooperative farm herself, has been for 30 years in the Fraser Valley. And so her experience and the experience of her organization, which is Farm Folk City Folk, is really to deal with all the, I guess you could say, complications and challenges of people living and working together cooperatively, forming co-ops, and all the different policies that have to occur in order for smooth running of a farm under those circumstances when there's more than one farm business operating and people are living on the farm and living together and working together. So that's her specialty and that's her strength. And then what I do to contribute to the partnership is that I work at the ways to secure the land. TLC could own the land. It doesn't have to be a land trust, but we could own the land. Or what we also do is provide different research and expertise on ways to secure land. We can hold a covenant. We could just provide information about how to form a land trust if an organization or a group of people wanted to form their own land trust, or we just help in any way we can to create, to facilitate the actual securement of the land. And we have been doing research, too, on ways, the different types of farm access agreements that are necessary when people work together on a farm, such as a lease or a license or a memorandum of understanding or a rental agreement. So we've been doing research on these documents and creating templates for that.
And this is Deconstructing Dinner. Again, this is part four of our ongoing series on cooperatives as alternatives to the industrial models of food production currently dominating our food supply. The series looks to examine the role in which the cooperative model can act as a viable alternative that allows for more community-based ownership in the businesses and services that we need and desire as part of our lives. Cooperatives are built on a number of core principles such as voluntary and open membership, democratic member control, member economic participation, autonomy and independence, education, training and information, cooperation among cooperatives, and concern for the community. This very radio station where Deconstructing Dinner is produced is just one of many examples of how such models can indeed be successful. And since this cooperatives series first began airing in March of 2007, we've met with grocery store cooperatives, food distribution cooperatives, food service cooperatives, and land cooperatives. The Community Farms program featured on today's broadcast is promoting the cooperative model as a means to ensure that farmland can be preserved in perpetuity. And Ramona Scott describes how the model can fit within the program.
I think co-op is a really good model for this community farm program where there could be a land co-op, which is the kind of the people that get together to own the land or buy the land through shares. And then the farm businesses that actually work together on the farm, they can form a co-op as well. And so you could have a farmer co-op. And then you could even have a housing co-op as well. And you could have other kinds of co-ops. So it's quite different shares, multi-stakeholder shares, and there's so much flexibility, I think, in using the co-op model.
Those segments featuring the Land Conservancy's Ramona Scott were recorded as part of an interview with Kootenai Co-op Radio's John Alton. Now again, the Community Farms program remains in its infancy. However, Heather Pritchard and Ramona Scott are optimistic of the growth potential of the program. In March 2008, Heather and Ramona hosted a workshop at the 2008 conference of the Certified Organic Associations of BC held in Saanich on Vancouver Island. The workshop was attended by current and future farmers looking for alternatives to the prohibitive and difficult models of land ownership currently dominating our modern-day food system. As part of the many recordings compiled at the conference, Deconstructing Dinner sat in on the workshop and prepared a number of segments to share with you on today's broadcast to help better introduce communities around the world to this innovative model of securing access to local food production in an ever-increasingly difficult time. For listeners not from British Columbia, you will hear a reference to the ALR in the next clip, and the ALR is in reference to the province's Agricultural Land Reserve. And here's Farm Folk City Folks' Heather Pritchard.
This session is about how we can secure farmland for local production, and we're going to workshop it. We have a presentation to give you. We have lots of time for you to be able to give us questions and feedback. What we know from making presentations is that there are three areas that are really critical to us. One is the actual model of how we do this, the farmland. How do we secure it? The other is how do we find farmers? And how do we train them, mentor them, prepare them? What are the economics around doing that? And most important, I think, is how do we build community around this? Because this is about community farm, and as we go through it, we will be illustrating to you what we mean about the kinds of communities we're talking about building on community farms. I would like to know something about who's here. How many of you are in situations where you have farmland and you're looking perhaps to make some shift to the next generation of farmers? So we'll talk about how we might do that. How many of you are new farmers looking for land and wanting to farm on that? Okay. We've got actually more new farmers than we probably have landowners. Before I go on to Ramona, who will start the program, and we're kind of a tag team, she and I, we want to say that it's really exciting to be here at COABC because it was 2 years ago at the COABC conference in AGM that Ramona and I, we had met before, but we really started to talk about how we might support each other in the respective programs that we were involved with our organizations. And we haven't actually stopped since then. We've had a lot of dialogue. We've had a lot of feedback from people. We've helped to develop the program. We've gone for some funding. We do have some funding. We're working with some farmers and some land. So it's actually, although this is the research and development stage, we're actually implementing some of this. So, right. On to Ramona.
The program itself is a facilitator, an enabler. Like, we are not the program that holds the land, nor the program that, you know, actually works directly with the farmers. Farm Folk City Folk is the farmer expertise, and TLC is the land expertise. And each of us have our own actual programs and individual organizations. So the Community Farms Program is a bridge, and it's an enabler, facilitator, broker, whatever. We're trying to figure out what word it is. And then out from all of this, of course, we hope to have a whole network of community farms. So we're facilitating the creation of a network. So what do we mean by a community farm? We call it a multifunctional farm where the land is protected forever for sustainable local food production, and there are long-term leases assigned for organic agricultural enterprises, and farmers are housed on the land. So we're looking at the type of production, and it is for local food production, multiple farmers, and it's in agroecological principles, and house, and farmers live on the land. Also, community farms, we think, are a very stable, viable model for small-scale sustainable agriculture in British Columbia. And when we talk about community in community farms, we are actually talking about two communities. There's the community of farmers on the farm working together cooperatively, and then the larger community that supports the farmers. Because farmers need to farm, and there's so much involved in communities' interest in farms that the larger community can do a lot of the support work, like education, you know, public access, events, festivals, volunteer labor. If it's a CSA, you know, they're very involved. So we've got the two types of community.
If, in fact, our community's invested in the source of their food or their food shed, what would that look like? The world is changing, as we know, and that people are much more interested in supporting local agriculture. But what we need really is to, we need this farmland not to be in speculation, even though it's maybe held in the ALR, which we are totally supportive to retain in the ALR. It has now become so expensive. It's under speculation, so it's really not affordable for most farmers. So we need somehow for that land to be taken out of speculation. It doesn't have to be TLC land. It could be cooperative land. It could be land owned by a society. We've got lots of examples of that in British Columbia already with people who have been farming where the land is not going to be sold. That's security. So then we obviously need new farmers. And they don't have to be 20. I mean, I started farming when I was 40, and I had 25 good years, and I'm still going. So I think it's we say new farmers rather than young. We're not setting up training programs because we know there's lots of you who are already doing that. So the idea is to support the existing programs that are already happening and then create new ones if we need to.
And this is Deconstructing Dinner, where we're listening to clips from a workshop hosted in March 2008 by Heather Pritchard of Farm Folk City Folk and Ramona Scott of the Land Conservancy of BC. Both are now involved in the Community Farms Program of BC, a project that's working on facilitating the creation of community farms throughout the province. In getting into more details as to how such community farms would operate and be managed, Ramona spoke on the role of the Community Farms Network and the role of the program to facilitate the ownership of land. Ramona is followed by Heather Pritchard speaking on how labor fits into the picture, yet another difficulty many farmers in Canada currently face when trying to operate a successful and responsible farm.
Philanthropy and member share structures, we're facilitating, the program is facilitating that. TLC may be one of the organizations that holds the land, but there could be other models too. So, but the purpose is to facilitate the securement of farmland and to promote farmland forever in public trust so that it is no longer on the market to be sold or speculated upon, and it would be affordable, and to attract new farmers, making sure that there's a link between farmers and farmland. We're starting databases both for farmers and for farmland, and making available, educating and providing information and resources on what are all the training programs out there, where can farmers be apprentices, where can they be mentored, you know, where can they get formal training, and provide that information too. And of course, the idea would be that farmers would have long-term leases for food production. And I guess I should emphasize that the Community Farms Program really is about securing farmland for food production.
That's
the purpose. Yeah. So we are researching leases, and we're looking at having templates for a lot of this stuff, because it's almost like you have to reinvent the wheel. Every time there's a new property or there's a new situation, you have to try to figure out how to do it, like what's the agreement going to say and how to do it and everything. We hope to have templates, and all of this will be on a website, which is part of the network, and everybody will have access to that. And then the housing that Heather mentioned, we don't say that we're looking for housing for farmers. What we are is, housing is necessary for farmers to be economically viable and live their life on the farm in order to do their farming. So therefore, there needs to be housing. And how to do the housing is what we're researching, and, you know, cluster and low footprint and that sort of thing, and looking at zoning and all that kind of stuff. And we're doing a project right now, kind of like a feasibility, that the Real Estate Foundation has financed, and actually Wanda Gorsuch, who is here, is the contractor doing that project, and she's looking at all the different, like the legal landscape right now that we're facing. What are the barriers and opportunities for all of these issues? And we're trying to just do the basis or the foundation for this information and make it available to people. The next slides that we have to do with the main aspects of community farms. Like, land stewardship is extremely important, because how the farming is done, the methods, the standards and things are very important. We're not talking about, you know, just, you know, wall-to-wall farming. We're talking about really great care and multiple use of the farm. So community farms have a really great benefit in that there will be more people and skills and diversity to manage the crops and maintain the soil and the healthy ecosystems on the land. And that's the vision. It's a multiple-use farm done in a sustainable way. So we have the people by doing
okay,
that.
And the next issue is labor. And one of the ways that I'd like to describe this is that we're not actually talking about farm labor as much as we're talking about farmers. So one of the ways that community farms actually supports a diversity of labor is that there's more than one person living on the farm, and that some people can be there and perhaps not work full-time. I mean, I know on our farm there's all kinds of diversity in terms of how many people work full-time, seasonal, or part-time, seasonal, or even just step in, or people from our community step in and give us the extra labor we need if it's like harvesting the apples or picking the beans or that kind of thing. I know that most of us who are farming also need to employ labor off the farm, but what we're trying to do is to provide a sort of stable labor base as year-round as we possibly can, which then extends into the seasons in the beginning and the end, and perhaps processing and other activities that happen on the farm. When you have a community of people on a farm, you have a way of getting a break. You have a way of getting away. What happens when you're sick? You have support. When it came to this slide, the young woman who lives on our farm, Donna, said what you need to do is tell the story about how her and David and their two kids went to Ontario when David's father was dying, and they needed to go in the middle of the summer, and we were able to kind of rearrange the work and bring more people on and just add to our work, you know, let the chickens out in the morning and all that kind of thing. And that's the kind of thing that you can do when you have more than one farming enterprise on the farm and you're working and sharing and supporting each other.
Heather Pritchard of Farm Folk City Folk. With the cost of farmland close to urban centers having skyrocketed since food became so undervalued as part of our culture, many farmers and especially new farmers have resorted to having to lease land in order to be able to farm. This does not, of course, provide much security to the farmer nor to the long-term sustainability of that farmer's presence in the community. And when ecological farming practices require years, if not decades, of living and working a piece of land in a specific location and climate, Finding a way around the risks of leasing is, too, an important component of the Community Farms program. And here again is the Land Conservancy's Ramona Scott.
On the farms, the idea of equity, building equity, because a lot of people wonder, well, you know, when you lease land, you're not really, you don't own it. So how do you, you know, what inspires you to stay there and really put your heart and soul into it? And we're looking into the idea that people can be building, farmers are building their equity on the farm and will be able to pass on their business to the next farmer. They will be able to sell it to somebody else. Because there is no, the land is never not going to be there. It's not being sold. Like, you're not leasing from a private landowner. You're leasing it from, you know, something that's in perpetuity, sort of long-term, forever. And so you can be building your equity. You can have a 10-year lease, a 30-year lease, a 40-year lease, and pass it on, or you can sell it. And then farmers can also get their everything that they invest in it, the infrastructure, and maybe even their houses. We're not sure yet how that might work. So one of the things we've touched on is succession, that we were losing a lot of farmers to retirement, and not so sure where the new ones are coming from. And there has to be a way that people are attracted to farming. It has to be viable and a rewarding career. And we think that community farms are attracting young people or new people committed to a sustainable lifestyle and the way that they want to live together. One of the hardest things is, and the many questions that we get is, well, how do people actually live together? And what does that mean, you know, and that sort of thing. But it's surprising how the newer generations are starting to understand the importance of being able to live in community. So community farms will be is an opportunity where the farmers that are there can pass on their knowledge, their skills, like John is, to the next generation, and then and they can still live on the farm. And we hope that we might even be looking at retirement, you know, packages and health benefit packages for community farm people or something like that. I mean, who knows where the program could go, but it would really support the idea of succession, which is a really big issue right now as to where new farmers are going to be coming from. The program itself, it's almost like a summary now, is that, like, we're based on land, of course, securing land. We're based on getting farmers, finding new farmers and training them, and then, of course, finding the finances to actually support the community farms program. And the first one, land, which is the one that TLC, in my capacity of our joint venture, is what I focus on. Mm-hmm. And so what the program is doing, by us being partners, what the program is doing is helping me to put a structure around why people could donate land or why we could purchase land, which is really difficult, purchase land, but donating, all the different methods that land could be secured, whether it's through even a lease. You know, we can have long-term leases as well. So through the program, what we're doing is being able to facilitate TLC and other organizations to remove the land from the speculative real estate market and put it in a long-term position not to be sold again. And also the program is developing the model and all the structure and the information that will support doing this, so that more and more people will support it and more people will be attracted to it. The way that we TLC as a land trust secures land is we do it through bequests or donations or endowments, covenants, and of course starting co-ops. We have done that. And we're also doing the research that it takes to develop the templates and find out the legal information, because that's basically our specialty, is looking at that sort of thing as a land trust. So that's what TLC can contribute to this partnership.
And this is Deconstructing Dinner, a syndicated weekly one-hour radio show and podcast produced at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY, in Nelson, BC. I'm John Steinman, and you're tuned in to part four of our series titled Cooperatives, Alternatives to Industrial Food. If you miss any of today's show, it will be archived under the July 10th, 2008 broadcast. This episode features the Community Farms Program, currently being expanded as a partnership between the Land Conservancy of BC, TLC, and Farm Folk City Folk, a Vancouver-based not-for-profit organization. The program has begun addressing one of the major barriers to ensuring viable long-term access to local food. And that barrier is the cost of land. The alternative being proposed by the program are community farms, which are a multifunctional approach to agriculture that produce additional outputs to food and fiber, such as ecological services, bioenergy, landscape preservation, employment, cultural heritage, food quality and safety, and animal welfare. It's a model that permits food to be incorporated into our lifestyles the way food has been for thousands of years, and in most parts of the world still is. Deconstructing Dinner recorded TLC's Ramona Scott and Farm Folk City Folk's Heather Pritchard presenting a workshop at a 2008 conference held in Saanich on Vancouver Island. Heather Pritchard has extensive experience working and living on and with cooperative and community-based farms, and as part of the workshop we're currently listening to segments of, Heather provided some examples of community farms currently in operation, and she introduced slides from two farms operating in the Fraser Valley of the province.
Those of you who know me know that I live on Fraser Common Farm Cooperative. So that's the community of people who own the land and who actually support the farmers and the farming on the land. Community Alternatives Cooperative is the land co-op, and the farming co-op that works on community alternatives is called Glorious Organics Cooperative. Used to be Glorious Garnish and Seasonal Salad Company when Herb and I started it 24 seasons ago now. And we moved from being a business towards being a co-op about 3 years ago. And we did that because all of us were aging and we wanted to open it up to a new generation of farmers, and we felt that becoming a farming co-op was the way that we could do that was most congruent with our values. And it also allowed new people to come in with very little capital and to be able to take ownership of the business on the farm. And that's Glen Valley Co-op, and of course John is like most of us. He's aging, and he decided a couple of years ago he was going to retire. So what Glen Valley did was they put out a call for proposals, and they had a proposal for a couple of young farmers, and they hired those young farmers on. They've just gone through their first season, and they've been really financially quite successful. And one of the things that they did in the criteria on this community farm or this cooperative farm was to decide that it was just as important for somebody who could communicate clearly and well and honestly as it was that they had lots of farming experience. Because when we're looking at community farms, the quality of wanting to be in community with other people was really critical. And they selected a young farmer, Chris Bodner, who actually had his PhD in communication. and he had decided at some point that he wanted to farm. He came from a farming background, and he is making that choice to do that. And it's amazing that there actually are a lot of young people who are doing that, who are saying that probably the most important thing I could do with my life is it to actually grow food. And the thing about Glen Valley, like many of these cooperative farms, is they're very diverse. They're not monocrops. They've got animals, they've got field crops, often salad greens, which is a good cash crop to have. They're stretching the boundaries from the beginning of the season to the end and have lots of poly huts and things like that, like many of you do, like many of the farming operations in BC.
There are a number of other examples of farms operating in the province as part of the Community Farms program. As mentioned earlier, part two of this cooperative series here on Deconstructing Dinner featured the early stages in the creation of one of these farms, Horse Lake Community Farm, just outside of the town of Hundred Mile House. In this next segment, Ramona Scott gives an update on the Horse Lake Farm, along with some background on one of the new farms coming on board, Lowbrunner Farm, just outside Victoria, in the community of Langford.
Horse Lake Community Farm Co-op is a property in near Hundred Mile House. It's 130 acres right on Horse Lake. And the property was for sale, but it had been leased for about 25 years, or no, actually it was 18 years, by Seeds, and some of you may know of Seeds. There had been a well-known group of farmers in BC, in the Chilcotin, and it had been leased for a long time. So Betty Johnson, who is the woman standing there, she wanted to sell the property because she was getting older and needed to get the cash out of the land. Now, she could have sold, and in fact, she did have it advertised for a while for recreational property, which would have given her probably another 50% to 70% more for her property, but she did agree to, once TLC started to negotiate a price with her, she did agree to sell it at a price that was reasonably affordable, and the co-op was formed, and it's through the member shares that this property is being purchased,
And they've made their first two mortgage payments, and so this December will be their last mortgage payment, and then the co-op will have pretty well secured the land. They're going to transfer title to TLC, and then they'll have a 99-year lease on the property. And Seeds is the primary farming community right now, but as some of you know, they've been farming for many, many years, so they're also aging. So they're starting to think, well, what's our succession plan? And housing is a really interesting issue on this one. They're building a log house from some of the pine beetle trees on the property, and they're also looking at bringing on a mobile, but eventually building another house. So the question of who owns houses and not the land is an interesting situation, and we think that it is possible to own a house and not the land, you know, just like you can own infrastructure and build equity and that sort of thing. So this is a working model that's starting to give us lots of practice for how to solve certain issues. The young fellow there is one of the Seeds, Rob and Lorraine's son, and he'll probably be in the succession. He'll probably be taking on farming after. And Horse Lake has been very, very active in bringing young people and their members. They have a campsite, a teepee, and they bring all kinds of, they have events. They might be having a music festival this summer there. They're very active in the community. They've started the farmer's market in 100 Mile House. So there's a lot of opportunity for this community farm to have a high profile. And there are lots of recreational property owners in that area. The other one that is really brand new is a property that was donated to the Land Conservancy recently in Langford, outside of part of the Capital Regional District. And in this case, Norma, who is in the lower right-hand picture, she's in her late 70s now. Norma Lobrunner donated this property, and she is going to be living on the property for the rest of her life, or as long as she wants to. But in the meantime, she gets to look out her living room window and watch some young people put this land back into production. And we've got Nicole there, who did farm a little bit there last summer, just sort of casually. But now what we've got is the beginnings of a group forming, so that they're forming a partnership. Three or four farmers are going to form a partnership and start farming there. And so we're just beginning the whole process of what are all the different issues and policies, and how are we going to deal with these questions. And we're in a good position with this one because we're starting from scratch, and we can address every problem sort of right from the beginning and practice, so it's a good one for us to be practicing. And of course, it's really near an urban center. It's going to have easy to market. It's right close to Luxton Fairground Farmers Market, and there's also a community starting to build around it as well.
Ramona Scott of the Land Conservancy of BC. While Lobrunner Farm is one of a number of farms currently being brought into the network of community farms throughout British Columbia, there is yet another in the Victoria area where community-based efforts are underway to bring it into the program, and that is Madrona Farm. Kootenai Co-op Radio's John Alton spoke to Ramona about this example, and here's a segment from that interview.
Well, we're currently working with a situation near Victoria right now, which is Madrona Farm. It has been in three generations of owners, and the brothers who own it right now are at a point where they're doing some estate planning. So they have nine children amongst them, so that they're wanting to sell the property to be able to, you know, divide the value. But the grandson has been farming there for the last 7 or 8 years, and been leasing it from the three brothers, which is his two uncles and his father. And so we're in the process of supporting or working in partnership with the Friends of Madrona Farm to actually buy the farm from the farmers, from the brothers, and then we'll be leasing back for 30 years to the current farmer. David and Natalie have been farming. They're just probably in their late 20s, early 30s, so they have a career of farming there, so they're going to be able to have a 30-year lease at least, probably for continuing to do the kind of practices they're doing right now. And they do a lot of really great food production. 10 acres is in complete production, and it's a very biodiverse farm. So we're quite keen on this one because it's quite a demonstration of the way conservation and agriculture work together.
As mentioned a number of times throughout the broadcast, the cooperative model of agricultural ownership and management is an alternative to how expensive farmland has become. In the case of Madrona Farm, it is those who have been fed by the farm who are coming together to take ownership of it.
No, it's very expensive, and it's quite a challenge right now that this is actually the first time that we've been part of a campaign to buy a farm. At the real estate prices nowadays for farmland and near urban areas, it's pretty amazing. So we're wanting to know just how successful this will be, and actually it's amazing how much attention and support this is getting. So I think people are starting to realize that the only way, if they really want to have a farm like this in production forever, and like thousands of people buy food from this farm right at the farm gate, if they want to protect it, the only way they're going to be able to do it is to buy it. And by buying it, they're having to pay the real estate price for it, the actual highest and best use price for it, which means that it's pretty high, over $2 million.
And that was Ramona Scott of the Land Conservancy of BC. And in this last segment, recorded in March 2008, here again is Heather Pritchard sharing the ambitious goal of bringing on 50 new farms in the next few years, at which point both Heather and Ramona hope to retire.
What we're doing is facilitating what is already out there, a lot of different community farms who do not know each other, or some do and some don't. So part of this program is to bring everybody together, to get a reference group of key people who are interested in supporting us, informing us, and directing us. That would be the first step. And the second would be probably next November, bringing representatives of all of these various community farms that have been practicing for probably 20 to 30 years and see how do they do it. What is their best practices? How do they create community? How do they set boundaries? How do they have agreements with each other, or do they? What is the culture that makes their community farm work? There are, in BC now, we've addressed over 20 farms that in some way there's a larger community that supports them, and there is more than one farming operation on the farm. Ramona and I are ambitious. We're going to do this for 5 years and we're going to retire, right? Mm-hmm. And in 5 years, we want to see that we actually have 50 such community farms in BC, and we think that that's a good target. We believe we can do that.
And that was Heather Pritchard of Farm Folk City Folk, based in Vancouver, British Columbia. You can expect a revisiting of this program on a future broadcast. And more information on the Community Farms Program partnership between her organization and the Land Conservancy will be made available on the Deconstructing Dinner website at deconstructingdinner.ca. Taking us to the end of today's broadcast, we'll visit once again with the two Ontario-based tricyclists who, since May 7th, have been making their way east across the country while they promote this radio show, Deconstructing Dinner. With signs affixed to their bikes, the two have also been distributing flyers, fielding media interviews, and maintaining a blog, which can be found by linking from the main page of the Deconstructing Dinner website. Last we heard from Derek Hahn, one of the two cyclists, they were both approaching the Ontario border as they headed east, and I caught up with Derek once again, this time while they were in Cacouna, Quebec, just 10 kilometers east of Rivière-du-Loup. While cycling across the country is never quite seen as the safest mode of travel, their entrance into Ontario confirmed that in some cases, the safety of pedaling down a highway is dependent on which province you're in. Ontario's roads have not impressed Derek and Sinesha.
Warning, the shoulders are pretty small and there isn't much room. And that being the main route for trucks to travel, you can run out of room pretty quick. Right? And on top of that, I don't know what's going on in the Ministry of Transportation Ontario, but whoever thought putting sandy shoulders on the side of the road should be fired, because nobody can bike on those. We have to ride on the pavement, or else you can't make any progress.
After spending days cycling without sign of much civilization, they arrived in the city of Thunder Bay, where they were interviewed by one of the many stations airing Deconstructing Dinner, and that was CILU, based at Lakehead University. The interview was a quick stop, and as they attempted to find their way out of the city, Derek and Sinesha both got pulled over by the Ontario Provincial Police, and both on separate occasions.
The night before, we were sitting down, having a bite to eat, and having some beers. And we were just socializing there, and we asked the waitresses about the best way to get out of Thunder Bay. For those who don't know, Thunder Bay used to be two cities that eventually just grew together. So as a result, the layout of the city is incredibly confusing because essentially there's two downtowns. So after we talked to the waitresses and then some of the locals contributed, they said, yeah, take the expressway. There's the signs that says no pedestrians, no cyclists. They say, oh, nobody enforces that. That's basically to cover your own butt for, say, insurance reasons or whatever, so that if something happens, well, it's your fault. So we took that advice, and at one point we got separated. Steve was turning around in circles, and I decided that I'd just meet him at the other end of the city because I was getting sick of that. And basically, long story short, we each found ourselves on the expressway. And at different times and at different places, we each got pulled over by different cops. It wasn't the RCMP, though. It was the OPP. In my case, the guy came over and just said, you can't be on this road. It's not allowed. And I just said, okay, that's fine. Can you tell me how to get out of here? And then he was kind enough to give me the directions to get out of Thunder Bay, and we had to take the long scenic route through the city and up and around, and finally found ourselves on the east side of Thunder Bay.
One of the goals of their Cross Canada trip has been to seek out local food if and when available, and also speak with farmers along the way. While Northern Ontario is a beautiful part of the country, there isn't much in the way of local food in June, unless they were to go hunting, fishing, or seek out wild edible plants. At the very least, once they arrived in the area of Manitoulin Island, Derek and Sunisha encountered one man who was so inspired by the message the two were trying to spread that he ended up taking care of their bill at a local restaurant. And so if local food is not readily available in that part of the province, at the very least, there's clearly local generosity.
We met a gentleman in Espanola, and he was him and his wife were meeting some old friends of theirs who lived in between Sault Ste. Marie and Espanola, and then these guys lived in Little Current. And as I was waiting for Steve to catch up, I was just sitting there, and we struck up a conversation with them, and we got onto the topic of our trip and deconstructing dinner and the local food concepts, and it was something where he said, well, you know what, I've been talking about this for at least 10 years. And finally, some people are picking up on this. My ears are pretty much done on it, but it's good to see that there's more people picking up on the idea and continuing the trend. So, yeah, after they left, they went in and prepaid for our dinner and just said, yeah, we took care of it. Thanks a lot, and nice meeting you.
From Manitoulin Island, the two deconstructing dinner cyclists took the ferry across the entrance to Georgian Bay and to the northern tip of the Bruce Peninsula. From there, they made their way to Wasega Beach, where a week-long break was in order to catch up with family. Both Derek and Sunisha are from the Southern Ontario area, Derek from Moncton and Sunisha from London. As Derek comes from a farming family, his parents were certain to arrive in Wasega Beach with a 100% local meal, the first since they were in Manitoba.
They brought basically a locally produced meal, and it all qualified within 100 miles of where I was. My dad is an organic beef farmer, and obviously being on a farm, we have a lot of homegrown vegetables. We had some of last year's potatoes and I think some of this year's first onions, green onions. Mom got some mushrooms and some cheese from the area, and then a couple of home-baked pies, one strawberry pie and one elderberry pie, which I'm well familiar with the bushes at home, and we sat down and just had a great meal.
Once moving on from Wasega Beach, they entered into the agriculturally rich areas of southern Ontario, and it was just outside of Peterborough where they quite literally stumbled across a significant site that they had first learned about on Deconstructing Dinner.
First thing I learned in Peterborough, when we stayed at the municipal campground there, and when we met the attendant that's taking care of the grounds, he mentioned to us that Peterborough has one of the oldest farmers markets in Ontario, so that was kind of interesting to learn about. And then from there, the next day, we moved on out of Peterborough, and we got onto Highway 7, which was just absolutely insane. It was the holiday Monday traffic, and, I mean, everybody just wanted to get home. So we got off that road real quick, And I'd seen a sign indicating that there was a plaque dedicated to the Red Fife wheat and where it originated. So that seemed like a perfect opportunity to go check that out and clear ourselves off the busy highway. And we made our way down to a little village called Lang, where they got a pioneer village, and it's all a little tourist area of how life was in the pioneer days and whatnot. And then that's where I found this plaque donated by or instituted by the Government of Canada, recognizing that area, that specific area, as the area that David Fife created the Red Fife wheat strain, and how that strain of wheat is what opened up the prairies and actually made life livable out on the prairies for a lot of pioneers out there as well. While I was out there touring around, we talked to one of the ladies that worked there, and she explained to us how there is a big interest and almost a resurgence of interest in Red Fife wheat, and how there's some local farmers that are growing the Red Fife wheat. There is actually even chefs and bakers that are coming from Toronto, and I think even from some of the schools, the chef schools in Toronto, that came to the area looking for actual Red Fife wheat because they want to do some baking with it as well. So there is a very big interest in kind of returning to the original strains that started our prosperity. And that is definitely an encouraging sign. I'd definitely like to spend a little more time around that area, and I'm thankful that I don't live too far away from it.
It was around the Peterborough area where the first of the Ontario strawberries became available, and even though it was Canada Day when they were departing the town of Campbellford, they happened to come across a farm stand selling fresh strawberries, and the experience for Derek was truly memorable.
And on our way out, we managed to find, it was on Canada Day then, a little stand, strawberry stand, open for business on the day. I thought everything would be closed, but they were there. And we picked up a couple of those berries, just enough to feed us for the day, basically, because they just don't hold up very well on our bikes. And they were just absolutely delicious. The first thing I thought of was I had a habit of buying strawberries off-season throughout the year when I was living in Vancouver last year. And, you know, most of those came from California and whatnot. And the way I describe them is they're strawberries on steroids because they're the size of half your fist and they're nice and big and red. But you know what? There's just no flavor to them. And as soon as I popped in one of these little strawberries, your typical size, the flavor burst right into my mouth. And it just reminded me of how important it is to grow a strawberry that's going to mature on the plant rather than trying to grow it big, get it big and juicy as possible, and then try to have it ripen on a truck or something like that. It just doesn't work out that well. You know, nature figured it out for us. Why should we have to try and expand on it or try to improve on it when they already got it pretty good?
All right. This tune is called Strawberries. Now, this is a song I wrote this tune for... The marketplace is on Vancouver Island, and I play in the summertime, and I decided to write a song called Strawberries just for all the people in the market. Here we go. Strawberries, strawberries, everybody get some fresh strawberries, all right. Strawberries, strawberries, everybody get them fresh strawberries, all right. Well, they're good and juicy and red and ready to eat. Strawberries, strawberries, make a mighty fine treat. Yeah, they do. I say they do. Ah, Lord, they do. Wow, strawberries, I love my strawberries, yeah I do, woo, they're all the good. I put them on my ice cream. I put them on my oatmeal. I put them on my girlfriend. What are you laughing at? I put them on your girlfriend. Strawberries. Woo! Strawberries, strawberries. Everybody get them fresh strawberries. All right.
And this is Deconstructing Dinner, and that was Eugene Smith, a musician from Vancouver Island. Smith has also spent time in the Toronto music scene, and his Strawberries tune is off his recently released album, Lovely Day, on Pacemaker Entertainment. Just as unlikely as it was to find strawberries being sold on the Canada Day holiday, it was also unlikely for the Deconstructing Dinner Cross Canada cyclists to come across a restaurant in the town of Tamworth that rivaled any other that they had come across.
We had probably the best breakfast we had on our trip to date. Since we've been in Quebec, that could be challenged, but it's a bakery slash restaurant where they get their eggs from a local farmer. They serve organic greens and then whatever else they can get locally or make themselves or bake themselves. From presentation of the food to quality of the food to quality of the people that were serving us the food, it just turned out to be a phenomenal experience. And I knew right off the bat that these guys would take an interest in Deconstructing Dinner, so I definitely took the liberty to leave them some information on the show and encourage them to tune in.
And the name of that restaurant is The Bakery. And contact info for a number of the unique stops that Derek and Sunisha have encountered on the way are posted on the Deconstructing Dinner website under a link found on the main page. As they rolled into the country's capital, Ottawa, on their trikes, they stopped at a store to stock up on supplies. And as they were locking up their bikes, a fan of the show recognized their signs.
And as I parked and locked up my bike, there was a gentleman that came by and then he recognized the Deconstructing Dinner sign, and I said, oh, you know about Deconstructing Dinner? And he said, yeah, I listen to the show from time to time. He's involved with, it was either a vegetarian or vegan food program, but he told me that he was a fan of the show. He listened to it on, like, he downloaded podcasts from time to time and listened to it, and we had a nice little chat about it, and I just explained to him that we're crossing the country talking about the show and promoting it.
And the last stop Derek and Sunisha made while in Ottawa was at the famous Byward Market, one of Canada's oldest, established in 1826. The market was swimming with food, and the two loaded up before making their way into Quebec.
It's unfortunate that we didn't have as long a time to check out the places as we wanted to, because it's just a massive market and beautiful. There's just so much food and goods available to you, and you know, I think we barely scratched the surface on what's available. But while we were there, we picked up some strawberries, we picked up some onions, we picked up some cucumbers, picked up some cheese. Most of it was either from the Ottawa area or from the Gatineau area, so I'm pretty confident that we did get a decent-sized local meal there as well.
And that was Derek Hahn, one of two cyclists currently making their way across the country on three-wheel recumbent tricycles. Derek spoke to me from Cacouna, Quebec. And again, you can stay tuned for another update on their travels. But in the meantime, stay posted to their blog, linked to from the Deconstructing Dinner website at deconstructingdinner.ca. And that was this week's edition of Deconstructing Dinner, produced and recorded at Nelson, British Columbia's Kootenai Co-op Radio. I've been your host, John Steinman. I thank my technical assistant, John Ryan. The theme music for Deconstructing Dinner is courtesy of Nelson area resident Adam Shake. This radio program is provided free of charge to campus community radio stations across the country and relies on the financial support from you, the listener. Support for the program can be donated through our website at cjly.net/deconstructingdinner or by dialing 250-352-9600.